Mr. M. Scott, real name. About what time of the year did you move to Eystad, Mr. Scott?
We moved to Eystad in the autumn of 42, or thereabouts. The move to Eystad was done by the Germans as a means of countering the tunnel digging that went on at Warburg, which was the previous camp. You have to remember to be recorded. There were so many tunnels dug there, or attempted tunnels, that they decided that Eystad, a camp of military type, three large blocks of housing, sort of military barracks type, and a place called the Garden City, which is at a slightly lower level than the main buildings, which housed people in mission huts. And these are rather important, connected with things that I'll explain as we go on through this particular camp. We were sent down there on a train, and we arrived at Eystad camp, and were detailed off to different blocks. The position would seem to have been that the escape committee, which I mentioned earlier on, had now begun to operate, and the theme of our sort of prisoner of war life was that we gravitated to a point where there's some considerable experience in escaping in many forms, land job at Warburg and tunnels and that sort of thing. And it was decided by the senior officers, Colonel Todd, and by the escape committee, that one tunnel would be dug only, and apart from one other item, which I will explain as we go on, that one tunnel, all our efforts would be put into it. And the efforts would be the point of view that vast experience in stooging, as it was generally named, which meant watching the Germans, and the sort of standard that we got it to was extremely high, and the Germans really couldn't make a move anywhere without us knowing. And there were lots of people involved in doing this stooging, which is a tedious job, but one which was vital to the success of that sort of tunnel that we were digging.
This would be people stationed in various areas where they could keep an eye on the Germans.
Yes, that's perfectly right.
And how would they get messages back to the...
They had a form of tic-tac from one to the other, which might be just a short distance to the next house or building, and then transfer them up to the roof and see them for some of the further along the camp. But it was all virtually, there's goons coming, goons being the Germans, or something wrong, and it would flash through straight away. And the position was that the decision to do this single tunnel was, in my opinion, an excellent one, because it employed a huge number of people in the camp, which made them feel it was worthwhile. And the original, without going into the details of the tunnel, but the original idea was that there'd be 34 first line escapers go through who were named, and it was done by regiments to a large degree. So the Durhams did very well, because we got four chaps in, three others myself. Which was, I think, a good share.
Did the escape committee made this choice. It was an advisory choice.
Yeah, it was made. You would put your name up. So, unwritten thing. You know, you were either with them or you were against them, and they knew you were all right. This point will come out in a minute in another aspect of this, which is really disturbing. The lists of people were made known only to the escape committee. And the thing was very hush hush. In fact, it was as tight as a drum, and it wouldn't have succeeded. I don't believe it had. In fact, I personally was always keen on escaping and trying to get away and that sort of thing. And I knew little or nothing about where the tunnel was, or where it was being dug, or who was digging it, or what, because it was all very hush hush. But eventually, of course, some of the people who were the main lights on this, that's Colonel Weldon, who was one of the main, or the main sort of chap, and a fellow called Jock Hamilton Bailey, who was a brilliant young engineer. And those two, between them, had a really, really controlled job, with a backup of lots of people who had experience also up to that point in prison of war and life. The hope was that they would get double the number of that 64, that 34 men out, if everything went according to plan. So that was always a challenge. Now, the tunnel, I will mention the tunnel now, sort of bring it in and bring it out again, was first of all, I put it a slightly different way, through the experiences that we'd had in huts, not in big buildings like the block buildings we were in, a substantial thing, the famous place to put a trap down to get a tunnel dug was out behind the fireplace, which would swing out of the, on the pivot and drop down underneath there. That sort of thing was a bit sort of easy to find by the Germans, and they had a very good idea what's going on. But in the case of Eichstadt, a segment of floor in the abort or the lavatory in block two was taken out, and there were six segments of stone flooring, and it was cut into one large piece and lifted out and cemented together, and sufficient room for a knife to go down a very thin crack, an ordinary knife with a kink in it, went and hooked it out, and you lifted up this thing, and of course you'd start with, just to give you an idea, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That was the whole piece that would come out, big enough to put a trap down. The Germans couldn't find that because the cementing in between the panels were so tight that they never picked it up at all. And the other very important point was that it was in an abort where the water was running down to the fence of your rival, and you could slow the place down, and there was no sign of anything when that was out. So that was really the master stroke to start with, and I'm only going now on personal experience, and of course there'll be a lot of people who will probably have more experience on this than I did, but I found after a while, and that indicated to me the number of people who must have been working on it without telling each other or something, an excavation was made below the trap, as we called it, and the whole of the excavation there, which is very large, was made, and this was another technique which came into play, which hadn't been done before, that instead of going down and straight along the tunnel and bringing stuff up for several weeks or so, months possibly, all the earth and everything was kept in here. There's no tunnel dug. It was all taken here. So that eventually you have 40 tons of earth taken out of there. And the excavation was pretty large. When it was decided to drive the tunnel, which was not long, 113 feet, at the gradient about 19 degrees, when it got near the horizon to the line, all the dirt that came back was stacked in little blocks all around this empty space.
So you dug out a very large area underneath your entrance?
Yes.
And that was used as a storage?
Yes, in fact.
How did you get rid of the earth you dug out when you dug the
I understand that. The carriers, not the watchers, the carriers, there were seven people carried, would take a bag and loop it around their waist and have a softest in there, and possibly between the thigh or some convenient place where it wasn't noticeable. And it would be taken away off the campsite. And if I could just give you a little, my head, there are three blocks, one, two, three. And then you went down onto a much lower level down here, and there were three or four mission huts there, just lightweight mission huts, which housed quite a number of camps. And the dirt that was taken out of this tunnel here was moved right round by individuals who went for a walk for the evening or something, and they call in there and drop their load there, and it would be put into the roof. And the Germans didn't pick it up very early. That's where it was put. And the rest, of course, came in here, so it was a balancing trick, really. And so that what transpired was there were a lot of people with carriers, and they had to be very careful. There were occasions when somebody made a mess of it and got a white coloured ground instead of being dark at the light. But what they do is they send out two or three of the extra carriers and just trade it in. The Germans didn't pick that up anyway.
That's when the dark soil from the
mixed with the soil at the top. Yes.
When there was a mistake made.
When mistake, yes. But everybody would try to be as careful as possible. So that was basically the basic routine. Some lot of stuff stored around there. Now, the whole of this tunnel was lit if that was a tunnel, a lamp would be put in there, and the next one, like a little refuge hole in a pit, another lamp would be put in there, and it would shine in the tunnel here. Now, those lamps came from the Garden City, where they had no electricity down there, and they had carbide lamps. So the carbide lamps were switched and disappeared. They had no business, wasn't it? And the Germans, no.
How did that work? If you took a carbide lamp from the Nissen Hut, was the Garden City. You took a carbide lamp from there. What did you replace it with?
I think that they just shuffled them around. I never got into that. I mean, it was just a matter of possibly putting them in a place where it could be spotted by the Germans, and another one or two. It was just a matter of transfer from a convenience point of view.
The carbide was supplied by the Germans for the lamps.
For the lamps, yes.
So they were in effect, without their knowledge, provided.
One day there was a hell of a hoo-ha started, and the Germans had found some of the stuff put in the roof of the Nissen Hut, and they said, "Oh God, that's the end of that." So they began to dig trenches right round the Nissen Hut, about 6 feet deep and about 6 feet broad. And it was warm, hot weather there. It was coming up May time when they found this. The German soldiers were brought in to dig there, and they were sweating blood. But of course, there's nothing down there at all. They were convinced we were coming in from there. And of course, it was all actually up this end. So the balance of that, plus that, going to there, it's got them a bit on the wobble. So now, when this was going on, I'll get to the tunnel a little later. When this was going on, we were greeted on arrival by Overs Blatterbar, who was a white pig, a poor chap, and he was a nonsensical. In a June day, or May or June day, red hot, he just insists that everybody went on parade with greatcoats on, no books were to be taken, or papers, anything like that, to read on parade, because they used to keep us standing around on parade for a long time. It's one of their little tricks. And he got absolutely wild about people coming up and reading the local video paper or something, and or a novel, and not taking any attention to their drilling and all this. So he got up and started to shout the odds. And actually, it was Charlie Hopeton, who was the Lord Inisca, one of the aristocracy appeared behind the scene. He used to have a chorus of quack, quack. When this Oberst chap came on there and said, quack, quack, quack. He was making fun of him, actually. And the German troops, I think, really rather enjoyed it because it wasn't a really nice man. But anyway, in the end, he got fed up and he had to go away because he had 2,000 officers on parade. They had a big camp. I say 2,000, so I figured random, but that must have been about that. We also had Canadians there, and that's a story in itself. But I just try to keep the continuity here, if I may. So we had this introduction from Blatterbar, and when he came on to the parade ground, obviously at the highest point, so that he overlooked everybody, he said, "You have come here from Warburg, which you caused trouble at," and he said, "You will not escape from this camp." And as the river, I can't remember the name of it now, runs around three sides of the camp, and there's a homogeneous rock face on the fourth side, so there was no hope of you tunneling out under the river or going up this homogeneous mass of rock to get out that way. So he said, "You now forget escaping." Well, of course, this was the way things happened. In point of fact, they lost 65. Out of there, and that was a wonderful exercise of masterly, in my opinion. But I'd like to make the point that being a young man, a young officer, and that sort of thing, a lot of these things that went on, I didn't get really to the pitch of the war. You know, if they'd been sort of major or something, I might have done, but I was pretty clear that knowing what was going on. But there's so many facets to this thing, because as you can see, it's a big exercise. So after he delivered his words to us, he said, "So you can just carry on now, because you won't get out of here." And with that, he walked out. Now, I'm just... in addition to the big tunnel being dug, which of course was top secret, a very brave effort was made by one of the senior officers, Colonel Brumhall, where he arranged with one or two of his colleagues to attend the main gate dressed in German uniforms with the necessary, presumably red braid on them, because they were high-ranking people. And what was going to happen was that the Germans were warned, that they were warned us, well, we found out that they were coming into the camp. I think it was probably a colonel and a general, possibly. And when they had come into the camp, it was a big camp, they went down to one end. While they were down there, the guard on the main gate changed, so they didn't know what the Germans would come in looked like. So our band of Germans all dressed up and went to the gate and shouted, "Achtung!" and all the rest of it, and had a shouting match, and they opened the gates and let them out. And this was a terrific success because it really niggled the Germans when the genuine chaps came back. To the gate, they couldn't get out. It obviously sold itself in the end, but it was a good little try, and they didn't get right away, but they got, I think, nearly down to the village station. But it was a little offset to that. In other words, we were trying as a camp to do something. And that really was a little offshoot. Would you like me to describe the tunnel?
Yes, if you would.
Yes.
The tunnel, its organisation, you've mentioned couriers, but there have been many other technical people involved in this.
Oh, yes. Well,
did you ever find whose brainchild was this particular tunnel and the way that it was constituted?
Well, I think without a doubt, Colonel Walden and
just give me a minute. You mentioned him earlier.
Yes, I mentioned him earlier. Hamilton Bailey. Jock Hamilton. They're the two. They're very clever. They're very different. In fact, Colonel Walden is a great man for horse jumping, you know, in the Olympics and things. Two fine men, they were very clever. And I think that was where a lot of the brains were, I'm sure.
So, what are the practical difficulties in a prison camp of deciding and planning to build a tunnel of this magnitude?
Well, really, they're very large because, first of all, we had to have people who were going to keep an eye shut, that sort of thing. That was easy because they were fine. There was rather an interesting point which did come up. When they were picking the team to go through the tunnel, go out by the tunnel, Colonel Merritt, who commanded the Dieppe raid earlier in the war, when the Canadians attacked the Dieppe, you know, as a fiasco, he got a VC when he was there. He was due to go down the tunnel, and also Colonel Labatt. French-Canadian. And this chap found it very difficult to go down the tunnel. He went down and he got stuck a bit, I think. And I'll explain why he got stuck in a second ago. So he backed out and handed his food ration, his clothes, his instruments, everything he had, over to the next man in, which was another Canadian. He was a very nice, very tough, and very appreciative of getting the chance to get out, because everybody was hoping to get out. And he changed there. He changed over. But they had a difficult time, by the way. As they'd gone down and opened that up, and gone off along the road here with the yard lamp being put in, they came across a thing called a coffin, which was a big stone which lying in the roof, and you had to slide under it. And it was not easy, but what you did was you pushed with your toes and pulled with the hands.
So it just must have been extremely low.
It was just there, yes, yes. Normally, if you were on your hands and knees, it was a comfortable walk up, and crawl up. But there was the coffin, and there were two or three. I'll have to, if we leave it up there, remember it in a minute. We went up the tunnel, up this 19-degree slope, and up to an area called Piccadilly, because there are lots of rocks protruding into the line of the tunnel, and we had to go around them. That was difficult. But I'll get that in a minute.
Did you yourself have any technical business to do with the tunnel?
No, I didn't have anything at all. I was one of the main ones going out, and I was about third on the fourth. No, Ken Hammond was in the DLI with me.
You were one of the four DLI men that was going out for this tunnel? Yes.
There was, who was that? There was Mickey Wynn, DLI, first lieutenant, he was. Ken Hammond, who I went with, he's shot in the face to me. And myself and Beaumont, those are the four. And there was certain parishes here and there, but as it happened, I never got involved in doing anything other than going out of it. Which was.
What were the measurements of the tunnel?
Well, I'd say she was about 2'6" by about 2'6", just enough to take an ordinary, fairly nippy. What happened was, this is where I think a lot of the brains came, and it was a very clever chat. You see, we're talking about 34 men going through that. And in point of fact, 65 went through, because it went as smooth as that. So all they had to do was call up through it. But mind you, you've got stuck now and then, and they've got a bit panicky, but that's another side of the story. The actual movement of people going into the tunnel, a list was made out of where you went and what. Who went with what you did. And it worked this way. If I can behave as a stupid little drawing here, so that's the block. It's a couple of stories in it. That was called a Henry. And all the people lined up to go down the tunnel were in the Henry there, the top one.
The top of the top story of the block.
Yeah, in there.
It was a three-story block, wasn't it?
Three-story, mm-hmm. And there was somebody quite placed at each vantage point to see if there was any kind of sort of seat, whether there was anybody coming that way. The whole thing stood. And that was called a Henry. And there was a little Henry further down. It was standing there. Little Henry there. So that what happened was when your number was called, you're 1 to 34, and then your number is called. It was a complete military operation. You went straight to the little Henry and picked up your bag, your luggage. And what happened there was you had a pack, say about 12 pounds of food and bits and bobs, and on it would be a rope. And a pair of hands there, and a pair of hands there, and in the body. So you'd be lying with the chap in front of his pack, it's your hands. Your belt would be around your waist, but the rope would go like this one, is between two legs, and the chap behind would have my bag. Ready to push it up. So we all.
Chappie Hand was pushing the bag in front.
That's exactly it. Yes. I'm supposed to explain that badly, but that's exactly it. We all went through pushing the chappie. Except that one was a Sergeant Major Perry was involved in this, and he was only mum off, so he was there. And one chap passed out a bit, and the word went sent down. It was, kick him in the face, Sergeant Major. The answer that came there. So I said, I can't reach. Luckily, this fellow came round. It was just temporary thing. Pretty claustrophobic business, you know. Even, I mean, it's all about the height of this table and that's so wide. It wasn't a gallery, but.
Would it have been easier for chaps like yourself who have been down pits?
Oh, yes. Well, there was a tremendous amount of sweaty, if it's the right word. People were very nervous.
Did people ask you, knowing that you worked in the mines, yeah. Did people ask you just what it was like, so did you get some idea before they went down?
Well, yes, but I think that people who were, you know, the three that I worked with, the DLI chaps, you know, we chatted amongst ourselves, and it was only the people who'd been doing the digging, and I didn't do any digging in it, I wasn't involved in that. Only the people who did the digging who really had the experience of being up and down. A lot of people were lying on their back trying to get these huge coffin stones out, and the belly crawl was the thing that just came back to me. The belly crawl was where they had to go over and under, you know, sort of.
Slide.
Yeah, that's right, yes. That was a bit awkward, but